Welcome to the latest edition of Consilio's Better Places podcast, where today we are joined by our regular guest, it seems now, given there is so much to talk about in the planning world, Simon Ricketts of Town Legal. Simon, thank you for joining us.
It's great to have this opportunity, Nick.
Brilliant, thank you. So very much the focus of this podcast is going to be the announcement that was made by the government yesterday in the alterations to the affordable housing requirements in London, amongst other measures. But I think it's important just to place it in context as to why the government has decided to take what are quite brave actions in many respects, which we will discuss, and that is the housing crisis that there currently is in London. Molyneux, as I'm sure many of our listeners will know, have created a lot of headlines recently with their research that shows development has really stalled in London, with starts totaling just 3,248 homes in the first 9 months of the year. Build to rent construction across the UK, but especially in London, is coming to a halt, and the real implications of this is that there's more than 132,000 households living in temporary accommodation in the capital, up almost 8% from last year, and this cost boroughs 5.5 million daily, and London councils have said £740 million black hole in all London councils because of this need for temporary accommodation, because of a complete shortage of housing that is being built. So the government have looked at this and have decided to go out to consultation on, as I said, amongst other things, reducing the affordable housing requirements. So Simon, I was wondering if you could give your initial overview of what the government's trying to achieve here.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting to see a joint announcement by the government and the London mayor, package of support for house building in the capital. First thing to say, I don't want some people to switch off, but there's nothing in this for developers of student accommodation or co-living. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a surprise that, you know, these are not this is not a package of announcements which is going to come into effect immediately. There is an indication that there's going to be consultation for 6 weeks, starting in November. We can discuss later, Nick, when we think the precise timing is going to be and what that means. So there's five components to the package of support. I know many people won't, but I do recommend that you read every sentence in the document, because every sentence has a nugget in it. But these five components: first of all, temporary relief from SIL for qualifying developments, and that includes, you know, 50% reduction in the borough SIL that that developers will be charged for residential schemes that commit to delivering at least 20% affordable housing, and additional relief available for high levels of affordable housing. That's going to need a statutory instrument. But that's the first element. Secondly, the mayor is going to remove certain elements of London planning guidance that constrain density, including standards on dual aspect apartments and units around cores, as well as some relaxing cycle storage requirements. Thirdly, really importantly, there's a new time-limited planning route, which is really a new fast track, which is where you can secure planning permission for residential development without a viability assessment, where you can commit to 20% affordable housing. Half of the affordable housing will be eligible to receive grant funding, and there'll be what's known as what's called in the document a gain share mechanism to increase affordable delivery on schemes that don't start by a particular deadline. Gain share mechanism, and another word for basically early stage review mechanism. We can come back to the timings on that, but basically you will need to have reached a fixed milestone of the end of March 2030 for construction in order to avoid that review mechanism taking effect. Fourth category, we can come back to later, but it's new powers for the mayor to potentially call in schemes of over 50 homes when a borough is minded to refuse, so a significant reduction in the current threshold, and to be able to call in development proposed on the Greenbelt and MOL, all with the intention of supporting additional delivery. Powers to streamline the mayor's decision making on called in applications, there would no longer be a need for the representation hearing. It could be done by written reps, so the potential for the mayor to really upscale the number of schemes that he's calling in and getting through the system. And finally, funding to establish a City Hall Developer Investment Fund, initial allocation of $322 million of grant investment. As I say, there's a lot more detail, but those are the headlines, Nick.
Well, if you can take a breath now, Simon, we can after that, there's an awful lot to unpack there, and certainly what has generated the most headlines, interest and commentary is the change to secure planning permission without viability if you are at 20% affordable housing. I mean, this is quite the change, isn't it, from the stance we have seen since Sadiq became mayor in 2016, and really is one of the major complaints which developers have had, which is that the requirements of a London plan, which date back to 2017, the world has changed in the amount of contributions developers have to give. And for whatever, it would be second staircases, building safety regulators, the massive increase in build costs meant that what in 2017 with the London plan was probably deemed a sensible and deliverable amount at 35% has just made far too many schemes unviable.
Yeah, this is going to be really interesting to see how it plays out, because after all, this is baked into London plan policy H5, the 35% threshold at the moment on private land, 50% on public land and industrial land. If you can commit to that much affordable housing, you're not subject to, you don't need viability appraisal, and you're not subject to late stage review. And the big question is, might be churlish to ask, but the big question is whether it's enough for the threshold to be reduced to 20%, although bear in mind this commitment that there seems to be that that half of the, you know, that affordable housing would be grant funded. Just drilling into the details a bit, of that 20% affordable housing, at least 60% would need to be social rent, and there's requirements in relation to the intermediate rent as to the levels of that. 30% have to be at or below London living rent levels, 70% a range of genuinely affordable levels. If you're dealing with public land and industrial land, rather than 50% as at present, the threshold will be 35%. Really interesting, and this is why every sentence counts, I'll read it out. For utilities sites that are subject to substantial decontamination, enabling and remediation costs, a 20% threshold will apply. So, you know, industrial land, potentially 50% down to 20%. Wow. This route's only going to be available until the 31st of March 28, or the publication of the revised London plan, whichever is the earlier. I think we can take it that means 31st of March 2028. Yeah. And all planning decisions on the application will need to, That's interesting wording. All planning decisions on applications will need to have been issued by the local planning authority by that deadline. So, you know, you can only qualify if you get your permission by March 28.
But does that mean at committee, or does that mean with a fully signed Section 106 agreement and all legal obligations? Because getting to a committee is relatively easy. It's my experience, and I won't name boroughs, but some do take an awful long time to get to the Section 106 side. So what would that mean, that wording, do you
think? Absolutely. You know, we don't know until, you know, the outcome of the consultation. All it says is all planning decisions will, because it says will need to be have been issued. I do take that as meaning the planning permission, so Section 106 completed. That's going to place quite a lot of pressure on us lawyers, but
it is. As we always say, there's always a winner, and it tends to be our friends in the profession.
I was going to say, and of course the mayor has the call-in power. So, yes. You know, if it, you know, if things are going slow for no reason, then you know, assuming the mayor is going to take a muscular attitude to all of this, then he can step in and hopefully unlock things which have got delayed.
I thought people would find it interesting to know the sums of money which are being talked about with respect to grants. So grant rates, benchmark grant rates are £200,000 per home for social rent, £140,000 for intermediate rent below London Living Rent benchmarks, £90,000 for intermediate above London Living Rent benchmarks, and then £70,000 for shared ownership. So that's the type of grant we are talking about, which combined with the 20% reduction, one would assume make it more appealing for developers to start. But what struck me just before we move on to the other issues was it's time limited, but you know, the world costs only tend to go one way up. It strikes me it might be quite hard to row back from, because I can't see anybody in the development industry saying, yes, let's go back to 35% when they've been working under these conditions. And more power to the mayor here as well in relation to this particular issue. Whoever the next mayor may be, it's Sadiq or whoever the next mayor is, they're not going to want to give up increased powers. So it strikes me once we go down this route, this is going to be hard to come back from.
These transitions are really difficult. Yeah, so it's storing up a real issue for the end of the period. The transition is equally difficult moving from the current position to the new permission in the case of schemes which have planning permission and may not have been built out or which are in the system. Maybe we'll come back to that. But also in terms of the affordable housing, of course, one of the blockers at the moment has been the reluctance of registered landlords to take on registered providers to take on you know, Section 106 units. And you know, there's a reference in the document to the government expecting and the GLA expecting registered providers, including local authorities, to be proactive in supporting this new route, including early engagement with developers to provide certainty that they'll acquire affordable units. And there's a nudge to developers that they really need to build schemes which are attractive and meet the quality requirements of registered providers. Now, is that plus that grant funding enough? I don't know.
No. But it is fascinating. There are 8,500 housing units either under construction or set to begin construction within 12 months, which lack an RP buyer. So it is always these practical points as much as the headline affordable housing figure, which need to be dealt with, which is why in and of itself, the affordable housing, whilst getting the headlines, is not the total story. Because as you mentioned, Simon, there's also the SIL changes, which I presume will also have a significant impact potentially.
Yes, I'll go on to talk about the SIL. The one further thing I'd say about that, this new sort of fast track route, is, as I mentioned, in order to avoid the gain share mechanism or viability review mechanism, you need to have got to a particular stage in the scheme by 31st of March 2030, and that for larger phased schemes, that will be you won't require a review where the for phases where the first floor of buildings provided providing at least 200 residential units have been built by that date. For unphased schemes, the first floor of the scheme has to have been built by 31st of March 2030. Now, I think there's going to be a lot of thinking about that and what that means in terms of strategies for phasing schemes, because at the moment, it's useful for a SIL cash perspective to phase schemes, but there's the opportunity here to bake in these relaxations as long as you commence development either on your unphased scheme or on the phase of a phase scheme. So there may be opportunities to have bigger phases or unphased. As far as the SIL relief goes, it's interesting that 50% at least relief from borough SIL, the mayor is keeping his SIL pot in place. and generally, what does this tell us about SIL more generally? If this money that was previously meant to be essential for accommodating for delivering the infrastructure needed to deliver development, suddenly half of it can be taken away. Well, great if that does unlock development and more affordable housing, but it's just interesting. So yeah, this is for schemes that commence after the relief is in place and before 31st of December 2028. And it covers 50% of SIL for schemes which deliver at least 20% of affordable housing under this new time limited planning route. The possibility for increases in relief to above 50% where a scheme's delivering more than 20% affordable housing, but there's no reference yet to how that is to be calibrated. That's going to be really important, because I do hope that some people are going to just be still bringing forward schemes that deliver more than 20%, and they really need to be incentivized to do that. There's a quite opaque passage that says the relief would be contingent upon meeting proportionate qualifying criteria to ensure relief is targeted at schemes which would otherwise remain stalled or fail to come forwards, with a lower relief applicable where the full available amount is shown not to be warranted. That seems to be some sort of get out that people need to be aware of. And this relief doesn't apply to greenbelt releases.
Right. I mean, it is, from our perspective on consultation, it is, what's the affordable housing levels and what are we as a local community going to get? Not that we have many residential schemes in London recently, which is, of course, is part of the problem, but that is the first question people ask. And on both measures, that's being decreased. So again, I think politically, this is a very brave move by the government, of which I certainly give it credit for, as a way to unlock the planning process. It's not necessarily going to be the most popular, but it also strikes me on some of the design changes as well. We've been told that dual aspect was a necessity. I don't think there's going to be any developer who is not glad to hear about the cycle requirements, as I always hear tales of thousands of empty cycle racks, and especially it's noted given the rise of e-bikes, e-scooters, etc. People just don't own as many bikes, but they are cycling more, so there isn't that need. Again, some of these design changes are things that we've been told were absolute necessities, and now apparently not.
Yeah, the last version of the MPPF did have did call for some flexibility over these design aspects, but no, I do agree. Perhaps Nick, we should look at what this means for schemes in different stages through the process, and we won't go through what the implications are at each stage, but I just jotted down for myself what do we need to think about if the application's not yet submitted, if the application's submitted but still undetermined, if it's passed resolution to grant and you're getting ready to sign the section 106, and now, you know, once all of this takes effect, are you better off waiting and taking this into account, or should you still press on? If you've got an existing planning permission, whether it's unimplemented or you're part way through building out a phased development, you know, what should you be doing in relation to the unbuilt phases? I think this is what's going to keep you busy.
Indeed. So should we tackle those one by one? So actually, let's start at the end, if you like, and then and finish at the beginning. So existing planning permissions unimplemented. How do you think this impacts them?
Surely one of the most urgent problems at the moment is stalled schemes that have planning permission, where people are basically keeping them alive by digging a trench or whatever, but and waiting for times to get better.
Yeah, 281,000 homes. Yeah, 281,000 homes, according to Molly, are currently in that position.
Yeah, so people need to, if they're in that position, it's just two paragraphs in the document, paragraph 33 and 34, and you know they're saying that basically. The expectation is you should keep to your commitments, but if you can demonstrate that that isn't possible, amendments to the affordable housing level or tenure should be renegotiated by deed of variation with the aim of delivering at least the level that is set under this new 20% planning route and on the same terms. That is dependent on the local authority and the mayor playing ball when you go to them and say, I need to renegotiate. So, you know, some guidance that encourages that would be really helpful. Mm-hmm. There has been a trend towards use of Section 73 to amend conditions on planning permissions, and in the slipstream of that, amending the 106 with the affordable housing reduced. That was done in the Cuba Street appeal in Tower Hamlets earlier this year. You know, the government, paragraph 34 sort of warns against that and says that the government will issue planning practice guidance in due course to clarify the circumstances in which section 73s can justifiably be used to modify obligations. Legally that's another route, but I think people are going to be warned against it. So we do really, so as I say, it's critical. And if the advice is that local authorities should be playing nicely over this, you know, query whether that's really enough, or whether a developer in that situation is going to have to make a fresh application for planning permission and go through and look to take advantage of these measures under that permission.
Before we go on to the without section 106, I just think it'd be helpful for lay people such as myself. So interpretation and guidance. We've got 32, 33 for Clover City boroughs, all of whom will be, their own lawyers will be looking at this. Again, as a layperson, how is that tackled by the legal team at a local authority? What do they need as part of this process to be sure that what they're advising developers, because you can't have one borough, I suppose you can have one borough giving different advice to another. Surely we need conformity across London. How is that guidance actually given as part of this process?
Yeah, well, first of all, some of this is going to need secondary legislation. That's the changes to SIL and the changes to the mayor's powers. When we look at the timing for that, and let's address that now. When they say consultation will start in November for a 6-week period, some people are assuming that means early November. There is, of course, a certain budget coming off the 26th of November.
Yes.
It could be later in the month, you know, maybe alongside that, after that, who knows? But anyway, the consultation isn't going to conclude until December or into January. And statutory instruments, you know, will take 2 or 3 months minimum to put in place. So we're talking, in effect, I think, of this not coming going live until the end of March. Wow. What do people need? They need those statutory instruments in place. They need the final version of whatever form of guidance is going to come out of MHCLG, and they need the mayor to have published what's called an emergency London planning guidance note, emergency LPG. But of course, those LPGs have no statutory basis. They're only guidance. You know, the development plan is the London plan. So we do have this like legal tension that the development plan is still saying that to get to fast track, you've got to achieve 35%, etc. Yeah. So this is all reliant on the decision maker, whether that's the borough, the mayor, or an inspector on appeal, saying, okay, the development plan still says, has these requirements, but I take into account current circumstances and advice as another material consideration. I give that more weight, and therefore, yes, I'm going with these lower targets. But obviously, some people out there aren't going to be happy, and are going to be looking for ways of sniping politically, sniping through lawyers, etc.
Exactly. And if this comes live in late March, obviously we have a local elections in May, and I can see in certain boroughs this being quite a topic in the run-up to the election. So interesting timing, if that is indeed the case. So I interrupted you mid-flow when going through the four scenarios. The third scenario we were looking at was applications which have been approved by committee but do not have a Section 106 signed, which there's probably quite a few out there in the boroughs, given it does take quite a while sometimes to get these through.
Yeah, and that's the one where there's probably the biggest dilemma, because you know, you may be weeks away from securing a planning permission. Yeah. Which is the devil, you know, or do you hold off to hope that all of this is going to come into effect in a form that gives you a potentially better outcome? That's something that's going to need to be weighed up case by case, and depending upon the level of pain that the viability on your project is showing at the moment, and frankly, you know, your appetite for risk and faith in the government and mayor.
So practicality wise, you won't be in a position to really know until, assuming the times we spoke about previously, until the end of March to know the actual position. The actual position of how this is going to be implemented. So it's quite a wait. It's quite a gamble, isn't it?
If someone's listening to this and thinks otherwise, they should let us know, but I'm afraid that's my conclusion.
So that's with about the Section 106 signed. Applications not yet submitted. What do we think? How do you think you should be assessing this if you're sitting there thinking, oh, do I hold off? Do I carry on? What do you think? What do they have to think about here?
Well, first of all, applications in the system where you've made your application and you got to committee. I wouldn't want committee decisions to be deferred by authorities on the basis that this is all now in the offing, but I can see that's a risk. If I'm acting for the applicant, I think there's a lot in here that would add to the case for, you know, the authority granting planning permission on the basis of recognition of the absolute crisis that we're in at the moment and the acceptability of lower affordable housing delivery in by way of percentage anyway in these circumstances.
Can I just ask a question on that point? So it just struck me, so when you go for a local plan process, it's given weight the longer you go on in the process, and committees have to recognise, I believe, or authorities have to recognise that the emerging plan is coming and therefore should be considered. We know, there's assumptions here, aren't there? We assume that after the consultation, the government will go ahead with a direction of travel which reduces the affordable housing requirements. How does that have to be given any weight, or is this literally you can't consider this until, assuming end of March, when this becomes legislation statutorily approved, that's when you have to take it into account?
In my view, this document already has some weight as a direction of travel that the government has indicated it it wants to go along. It has some weight. Obviously, it will have more weight once the consultation has been carried out and concluded. So already, this is absolutely something that will be being referred to in closing submissions at inquiries over the next few weeks, and in representations at planning committees. So that's applications in the system, and it applications not yet submitted. Well, absolutely, emerging schemes should be, and pre-app discussions will need to be having these likely this likely policy background in mind. And it will be, it'd be interesting to see whether it influences some of the decision making in terms of whether to, the relative attractiveness of co-living versus another alternative residential models versus traditional C3. I don't know.
That was my thought as well, because certainly from a business perspective, co-living and student really is the only residential schemes that we've been asked to tender for or work on in the last year. Very, very few what you would call traditional private sale or rental. It has all been co-living and student, I guess, because of the viability challenges. And I was wondering, does this tip the balance back in favour of residential, traditional residential, rather than co-living student? It's going to be fascinating to see if that's the case. I was just trying to think of outstanding tenders. Almost all of our outstanding residential tenders in London are co-level student, not traditional residential. So,
I mean, there is a question mark as to whether this support should be extended to co-living, because co-living meets a segment of the market's needs very well and can be delivered quickly, the same as build to rent. So is it right that these measures aren't, and also it must be said that the mayor's London plan policies in relation to the affordable housing requirement, the off-site contribution requirement in relation to co-living is very tough at the moment. So we really do need to see equivalent relaxation in that, I would say.
With the consultation beginning in November at some point, I'm sure the co-living sector will be putting their arguments forward as to why they should be included in the process. So, Simon, thank you very much for your time this morning. We'll dub it an emergency podcast where we try to bring guidance to what is, I think, going to be quite a long-standing fundamental change, because I come back to it in my own view. No developer is going to say the conditions are right to go back to how it was, and no mayor is going to want to give up the additional powers that have been granted to them here. So I think this is a real fundamental change to the system.
I agree.
Brilliant. Simon, thank you very much for your time. Thank you.